Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 28th of August, these are our main stories. The Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro escalates his dispute with the French president over the fires raging in the Amazon.
We have nothing against the G7. On the contrary, we're against one president of the G7. We know what he's insinuating.
The women who've accused the late American financier Jeffrey Epstein of abusing them sexually have their day in court. Also in this podcast, how insects could be the future of pet food as long as they're treated humanely.
They're taken into a cool environment, they start to feel a little bit sleepy. Then in a fraction of a second, they are turned into insect flour.
And the radio station broadcasting on two wheels in South Sudan. The fires in the Amazon are raging on, and now there's a political row between Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro and his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron, which could have a negative effect on efforts to put them out. President Bolsonaro said Brazil would only accept $20 million in aid from the G7 to fight the fires when President Macron apologized for insulting him. Here's what Mr. Bolsonaro said at a meeting with regional leaders.
We have nothing against the G7. On the contrary, we're against one president of the G7. We know what he's insinuating, what is his intention and why, and there's no doubt about that.
Ricardo Senra from BBC Brazil is covering the story. So why is the Brazilian president so angry?
It seems to be a personal matter between both presidents. President Bolsonaro has shown signs of seeing President Macron as someone who threats the Brazilian sovereignty. The idea of the Amazon as a common land or as an everyone's space irritates a lot President Bolsonaro. And this is how he has been interpreting President Macron's statements about the Amazon. This is a new diplomatic problem for Brazil because, as we know, President Bolsonaro has made very harsh comments towards President Macron. He's mentioned the First Lady, and we know he's endorsed a very sexist comment about the First Lady. So, yes, the situation now is very personal. We expected today he had a very long meeting with his cabinet, a lot of different governors. We expected to hear a lot on the efforts to control the fires, but mainly we heard about what he sees as a NGO lobby or a foreign lobby as a threat for the Amazon. And President Macron was mentioned for different times during the day.
Yes, sticking with this issue of the Amazon and the way it's seen in Brazil versus the way it's seen perhaps outside of Brazil, this isn't the first time a Brazilian leader has criticized richer countries for trying to intervene in the Amazon, is it? I remember President Lula being very forceful about this too.
This is true. This is a discussion in Brazil since the military dictatorship during the 60s, the 70s. The military governors had created this slogan, "The Amazon is ours," and that became very popular in the country. And this has been repeated during the years. Even President Lula, as you've mentioned, I remember him saying in 2009, he said foreigners should take care of what's theirs, Brazilians can take care of what's ours. So yes, this is a discussion that has been going on a lot in Brazil, and this is one of the few topics that unite the left and the right in the country right now.
Ricardo Sendra from BBC Brazil. He was awaiting trial on sex trafficking and conspiracy charges, but while facing up to 45 years in prison, if convicted, Jeffrey Epstein killed himself in his prison cell. Usually, this would mark the end of a trial, but today in New York, women who say they were sexually abused by the financier were given a chance to speak in court. One of those who spoke at the hearing was Jennifer Arroz.
It was so powerful in there, hearing all the other victims and very similar stories that I have endured. I wanted to thank the judge for letting us speak, having some closure.
Our correspondent Chris Buckler was in court for the testimony.
The judge asked anyone who had been abused by Jeffrey Epstein whether they wanted to speak, and a podium was set up at the front of the court. And at one stage, a long line of women stood up, and made their way to the front of the court. And each one of them told a story about how they were abused and exploited by Jeffrey Epstein. There were different stories, but there was a thread that ran through them, and it was how they were manipulated by a man who one of them described as a complex villain. Some described how he abused them, or how he assaulted them, how he raped them. And others talked about the difficult relationship they had by a man who clearly manipulated them. At times they talked about just having difficult feelings even when he was dead, and not knowing at some stage whether or not they could ever have closure as a result of the crimes that had been committed against them. And some just said that they wanted to see him in court face justice. And of course, now that he's dead, that can never happen.
So usually after the death of a defendant, that would have marked the end of a judicial process. Why did this go ahead?
The judge actually reflected on this because he said that there were some people who had been critical, for example, in law journals and suggesting that this should take place, that victims should be allowed to stand up and to give testimony essentially unopposed. But he said it was appropriate in this case and it was something that he felt was important. And he was praised by some of the defendant's lawyers for that. What was clear, though, was that he wanted to give them a voice after all that had happened. And clearly Jeffrey Epstein dying is an issue that has led for this trial to stop. But it's not going to stop other cases, civil cases going ahead. And what they were clear to point out as well, prosecutors, was that as far as they're concerned, they are now going to continue their investigations into who they described as co-conspirators, those who helped them exploit and abuse these underage girls. And from the defence point of view, there were also other questions raised. Some of Jeffrey Epstein's lawyers said that they had concerns about the medical examiner's report into his death. They said that they had real suspicions and concerns that it was not suicide. They said some of the evidence pointed towards an assault as opposed to Jeffrey Epstein killing himself. And they said there were questions about how he was looked after at the jail, which have been raised before. But they spoke specifically about video footage that was taken outside his cell in a corridor there. They said it was corrupted and it was not able to be viewed. And they said that in itself raised many questions.
Chris Buckler in New York. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said Turkish troops in northern Syria are in danger and will defend themselves if necessary. After talks with President Putin, Mr. Erdogan said recent attacks by Syrian troops in Idlib had disrupted the calm established there by Russia and Turkey. Jonah Fisher reports from Moscow.
Despite being on opposite sides in the Syrian conflict, relations between the Russian and Turkish presidents are good. But the Turkish leader called the ongoing Russian-backed Syrian government offensive on Idlib unacceptable. He said it had killed hundreds of civilians, forced many more to flee, and put Turkish forces stationed inside Syria in danger. President Putin was conciliatory but firm, saying that there were what he called nests of terrorists in Idlib.
Now, it's often said, not just by us, that radio provides the most vivid pictures, and that's especially true in some remote frontline areas of the world where access to TV or printing presses is limited. Radio Boda Boda Talk Talk in South Sudan is one such place. Our correspondent, Mike Thompson, has been to visit this very special radio station, which operates in the country's biggest camp for displaced people near Bentiu in the far north of the country.
A boisterous crowd gathers around a battered old motorbike in South Sudan's largest camp for displaced people, near the battle-scarred northern town of Bentiu. Then, at the press of a button, this two-wheeled radio station bursts into life.
My name is Adeboru. I'm working with Boda Boda Talk Talk in Wau. Boda Boda is a motorcycle taxi. And these Boda Bodas can go in places where the vehicles cannot reach. So what we do is mount speakers, huge speakers on this Boda Boda, and then travel the market areas in the zones where the camp is arranged and people can listen. People are curious. Everybody start running to where the radio is. Usually we start with the music to attract people, And these motorcycle taxis has become kind of a moving radio that can come and play for them the information that they need to hear.
You are listening to Boda Boda Talk Talk.
These pre-recorded radio programs, many containing the latest news and information about local food supplies, tent repairs and security issues, are put onto memory cards and then broadcast from these roving Buddha Buddhas or motorcycle taxis. Port Panwan of the NGO Internews, which helps fund the project, tells me that listeners have their say too.
We do a live radio talk show in the studio, and then people call in, they report their concern, they respond, they react to some of the topics that being broadcast on the radio, and we go and pre-record their voices also in the camp and outside, then we come and play this thing on the radio.
At the height of the Civil War, 120,000 people sought refuge in this UN Protection of Civilians camp, or POC, and most are still here, more than 5 years on.
Currently, there are over 100,000 people living in the camp now. People are now thinking, like, if the peace is implemented, maybe the next focus will be the return to the original places. But now they are not sure whether the places are safe or not.
This is where the Buddha Buddha motorbikes are proving especially useful. Until recently, they kept within the boundaries of the camp, but now they're travelling way beyond it to the villages that people fled from, checking what the security situation is like there, seeing who's returned, and relaying messages to their relatives back in the camp.
When we collected those greetings and laid them here, then, it is amazing. People are also responding, and we take back this greeting and messages to their relatives that they have been separated for years in those villages. And people are now getting information about their places and what services is there, and it's okay for them to stay there.
And although the security situation in some areas is still fragile, Port Panwan says life is slowly getting back to normal.
That report from Mike Thompson in South Sudan. Let's change gear a little now with a question. Do you spoil your pets at dinner time?
Today is the second anniversary of his operation, so I thought we'd celebrate. I went out and got 2 pounds of Aberdeen Angus fillet steak, marinated it overnight in olive oil, peppercorns, lemon thyme, crushed garlic and sliced Spanish onion. And he hated it. He said he wanted This stuff.
New Chunky Meat gives your dog the meat and other good things he needs. In chunks, the way he likes it.
Indeed. Well, you might not go as far as the British chef and broadcaster Clement Freud in that TV commercial from decades ago, but how would you respond at this suggestion from the president of the British Veterinary Association, Simon Doherty, to feed your pets insects?
Insects have been available as a protein source for aquaculture, for fish farming, for quite some time now. It's a very rich protein source in terms of environmental sustainability. We can use otherwise waste products or byproducts from the food industry to produce a very stable protein addition that can be used in pet food.
So why are some vets keen on us feeding insects to our pets? A question for our environment analyst, Roger Harabin.
Well, there's been a succession of international reports recently warning about the impact of intensive agriculture on the environment. A lot of attention has gone to deforestation in Brazil, to grow soya, to feed to cattle, to feed to humans. Animals, typically in the UK, animal food is mainly based on offal, the sort of stuff that people in the UK don't generally want to eat, like maybe heart and lungs and kidneys, which used to be eaten but are now really no longer wanted. But the vets are suggesting that if those animals that currently are eating our offal can be persuaded to eat insects instead or insect protein instead, that will free up the offal to be exported possibly to East Asia, where it will be readily gobbled up by people rather than pets. And they think this is a good idea.
Yeah, maybe the pets won't, or...
We did look at that, and I went to a local park, and I got an extraordinary series of responses. One woman said, oh, my dog, you know, she's very fussy, she won't eat anything. Oh, look, she's eaten them all. And another man said that he was a vegan and had to struggle with his conscience to feed his animal meat. He felt like the insects were going to give him a kind of a way out. Actually, the insect protein is the same as animal protein. Cats, for instance, cannot live on a diet without meat or fish, or, crucially, insects, but they're not normally part of the equation.
And where would all these insects come from?
They are farming them in absolutely massive scale. I visited a factory, an insect factory in Holland, giant warehouse, where they've got a tank, I guess about 1.5 times as big as an Olympic swimming pool, full of black soldier flies. And that takes up about a third of the plant. There's still two-thirds of the plant left. And that is full of trolleys, full of wriggling, seething grubs that look a bit like what in England we call woodlice. They get treated humanely, according to the pet firm. They have to be treated the same, with the same reverence as any other livestock. And so they're taken into a cool environment where they start to feel a bit chilly, and it gets a little bit cooler, and they start to feel a little bit sleepy, and then they go into a hibernating state. Then in a fraction of a second, they are turned into insect flour.
Right. I think I want to leave it there. And so we did. That was Roger Harabin. Still to come in this podcast, new measures to stop the capture and subsequent sale to zoos and circuses of baby African elephants. A year ago, New Zealand's government took action to protect local house hunters by introducing legislation barring most foreigners from buying property. Our correspondent, Vivian Nunes, has been looking at whether the new law has actually addressed the affordability crisis.
In a pretty suburb, a short drive from the centre of Auckland, we met Sarah, who works in film and television. Recently, she's been living in a rental property with her daughter, her partner, and his daughter. She describes the house hunting experience as excruciating.
Everything was going to auction and really quickly, and they were just selling so fast. It was it was dismal from where I was sitting.
So what was behind this overheated market? Greg Ninnis, property editor of property.co.nz, says it was a shortage of housing stock and an influx of Chinese money.
At some of the bigger auctions where they might have 20 or 30 homes going up for sale in the room, it could be quite frenzied. That was mainly driven by Chinese buyers at the time. As well as that, we had a lot of people in China who wanted to get their money, or at least some of their money, out of China. Property was a very popular vehicle for them getting money out of China.
The law does seem to have had some impact. House prices have dropped by around 7% in Auckland's top suburbs. But affordability is still very much an issue, with 40,000 people living on the streets or in emergency accommodation. Still, Peter Thompson, managing director of the real estate firm Barfoot & Thompson, which dominates the New Zealand market, is cautious about drawing too much of a conclusion about the impact the foreign ownership ban has had on the housing market.
The sale volumes have dropped. But it wasn't just what our own government did. When the Chinese government changed the restriction on how much they could take out of China was really the main factor that slowed the market. But certainly the government had brought in new legislation for all foreigners that, sadly, I'm not sure if it's the right direction that we should be going or not. We have to encourage investors to buy properties to invest, because so many people are having to rent. You know, if we take those investors out of the market, we're going to have a shortage of investment properties for people to rent, and that could be another big issue.
Hopeful buyer Sarah says now, rather than being ignored after an open house, real estate agents are much more likely to keep an eye out for properties that fit her needs.
I was suddenly being phoned frequently after attending an open home. My details were being taken. I was being pursued.
She says she's just pleased that buying a home is no longer out of reach.
Vivian Nunes in New Zealand. A doctor in Indian-administered Kashmir has been taken into custody after he demanded that the government restore internet services to allow patients to be properly treated.
Mobile phone services and the internet have been suspended since the Indian government revoked the region's special autonomy earlier this month. This report from Ambarasan Etirajan.
Speaking to the BBC in the city of Srinagar, Dr. Omar said without the internet, it was difficult for hospitals in Kashmir to provide free treatment to the poor under Prime Minister's health insurance scheme. This uses a smart card on which patient details can be accessed via the internet. He warned that the health issue could soon become a humanitarian crisis. The Indian government maintains that the situation in Kashmir is normal and there is no shortage of medicine. The entire valley of nearly 7 million people has been put under a security clampdown and normal life has been paralyzed.
Ambarasan Etirajan. We've had airborne drones for years now, but what about drones in the sea? Well, a British company has developed an unmanned vessel capable of being deployed underwater. Powered by satellite communications, it can be operated from anywhere in the world, and it's hoped that the new floating drones could be used for cleaning up oil spills. Neil Tinmouth is the chief operating officer for the company SeaKit.
The main benefits that you get from this type of system is it removes people from a dangerous environment and working at the ocean, in the oceans. It also hugely fuel efficient. I mean, we're operating at about 5% of a standard ocean-going vessel. On top of that, it actually helps reduce costs for our customers and clients.
Okay, so how does it work?
So the system is operated via various different communication techs. So we can basically move from marine broadband radio through to 4 and 5G, through to VSAT and Iridium, so your satellite communication systems. And then that can be operated from anywhere in the world.
So it really is an ocean-going drone then, really. Why has it taken so long to develop it? We've had drones in the sky for years.
When you're sending something out into the ocean, thousands of miles offshore for long periods of time, you need to make sure it's going to be working 100% of the time. So the testing phases of this just take a long time. And it took a competition to actually push the development of this tech. I mean, in previous years, these type of things would have taken 5-6 years, maybe even longer. But in this case, it was developed and tested within 3.
I suppose, though, it does mean that if it suddenly had to take evasive action, I don't know, an iceberg, a huge whale, I don't know, that sort of thing, there would be nobody on board to make that decision.
Well, again, that's what the benefit of unmanned versus autonomous technology is. And with autonomous technology, you're relying on the sensors to make the full decision and then calculations and algorithms to determine the course of action. Whereas with unmanned technology, we have CCTV cameras, thermal cameras, LIDAR, that type of sensors can be employed, whereby humans based in the control center, which could be situated, say, in our office in the UK, for instance, they can then see what's happening around it, use all the information from the various sensors, and then actually take the right course of action. So you're actually not removing people completely from that decision-making process.
And how long before the seas are full of these things?
I reckon in next year you'll start to see it become a little bit more commercially popular, and in the next 5-10 years it'll just continue to increase.
Neil Tinmouth from SeaKit speaking there to my colleague Rebecca Kesby. A study in the United States has found that people who are optimistic tend to live longer than those who are not. The research may have important public health implications, as other studies suggest optimism can be boosted by simple therapies. Ben Ando reports.
This American study of nearly 70,000 female nurses and 1,500 ex-service men looked at the impact of positive thinking. In 1986 and 2004, the subjects filled out questionnaires. And as the years passed, the researchers found that those who were rated optimistic were far more likely to reach 85, with lifespans between 11 and 15% longer than the most pessimistic. The reasons aren't clear. The scientists think it could be that optimists bounce back from stress or difficulty more easily. But they say relatively simple techniques can help anyone learn to look on the bright side of life and live longer as a result.
Ben Ando. And we end this podcast with news that's likely to be welcomed by animal lovers. Baby African elephants can no longer be captured from the wild and sold to zoos or circuses. A near-total ban on their trade was approved on Wednesday at the meeting in Geneva of CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. I heard more from our correspondent attending the convention, Imogen Folks.
The wildlife conservationists have been saying for years, pointing to the really
quite drastic decline in elephant populations worldwide. And I think the feeling is now that anything which might encourage the capture of elephants in the wild is threatening their existence on the planet. And so, although it was quite a heated debate, what the member states of the Convention on Trade in Endangered Species have signed up to is no more sending of African elephants captured in the wild to zoos or indeed to circuses. One very small exception backed by the European Union, and that was to say there can be an exception if it is viewed to be in the interests of the elephant species.
But in the wild, elephants are also exposed to dangers from the likes of poachers, for example.
That's absolutely right. But going along with the debate about the transfer of live elephants, there has been a huge debate about the trade in ivory here in Geneva. And again, a lot of pressure being put on to just ban the trade altogether. Huge pressure come on Japan to basically ban the import of ivory. It hasn't quite gone that far, but Japan remains now pretty much alone as a country that says it still wants to buy ivory. And I think although we haven't seen a full and final ban on ivory trade, that too is almost certainly coming.
So how dire is the situation for elephants? How close are we to seeing elephants become extinct?
There were, in the 1980s and 90s, close to 1.5 million. Now, less than 450,000 wild elephants. So I think we see that that's a very, very drastic reduction in a pretty short space of time.
Imogen Folks in Geneva. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. We're calling on your help to make your listening experience the best imaginable. All you need to do is take a short survey. Visit acast.com/survey. That's acast.com/survey. Your opinion matters.